are here for me.
I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We have a quorum. We do have multiple bills on our agenda today, but first we need someone to move the minutes for March 7, 2023. Representative Frazier.
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right. All those in favor of the minutes for March 7th, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes for March 7th, 2023 are approved. The first bill we have on our agenda today is Representative Freeman's bill, House File 635. I will move your bill, and I believe the motion is that House File 635 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. We don't see any amendments on your bill, so please go ahead and tell us about your bill, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And since I suspect most people here aren't here for me, I'm going to try to be brief. We won't have testifiers in this committee. And I am really grateful to present House File 635. It's a bill to protect election workers and our system, the tens of thousands of Minnesotans who step up to help run our elections each year. We heard and discussed the full bill on elections, and in the interest of time, I'll focus my remarks on the jurisdiction of the Public Safety Committee, specifically the criminal penalties related to the prohibition of intimidation and interference with the performance of election duties. In Minnesota, we have a proud tradition of strong and secure, trusted local elections administration. Every cycle, 30,000 of our friends and neighbors in every community in the state pitch in to help prepare and staff our polling places, prepare and send absentee ballots, print and process ballots, and canvass results. For some, it's just something that they do a small proportion of their year, and for some public servants, it's a main part of their job serving the city or county year-round. In 2020, Minnesotans put in a historic and heroic effort, in some cases putting their health on the line to ensure that communities had safe, secure, and well-run elections during a global pandemic. Since the 2020 election and the January 6th insurrection rooted in the lie of a stolen election, their job has only gotten harder and the pressure more intense. Many of the Minnesotans are the same election workers who have done this work in their community long before 2020. And for years, they have worked in the background, quietly and efficiently doing their jobs to ensure our elections run smoothly. These are private citizens doing apolitical work of conducting an election. But unfortunately, in the last 3 years, the increasingly tense political environment, aggressive rhetoric, disinformation about elections and social media has involuntarily thrust these men and women into the public spotlight. This has happened around the country and here in Minnesota. Disinformation about voting machines, disinformation and lies about election fraud, and an irresponsible and misplaced targeting of local election and public servants have all contributed to increasing fear and insecurity amongst those who administer our elections. In some cases, election workers have been directly targeted with death threats and other pretty extreme behavior. We've seen extreme examples of this across the country. Credible death threats at the Madison Municipal Clerk, Executive Director of the Milwaukee Elections Commission, in Philadelphia, County Commissioners, and in Georgia, the Secretary of State on down have received death threats, and the Georgia Secretary of State so severe that they had to leave their house. These are the most extreme examples, but there are many more. And across the country, examples like these and fears surrounding them have had an impact on the people and the volunteers conducting our elections. In 2022, the Brennan Center did a survey of election reporters and reported that nearly 1 in 6 have experienced threats, and 3 in 4 local elections administrators feel the threats against local elections officials have increased in recent years. And we have seen efforts to tamper and interfere with the elections infrastructure. In Colorado, in Georgia, in Michigan, we saw deeply troubling and illegal efforts driven by the big lie. We saw clerks and party officials attempting to provide unauthorized access to voting technology and voter lists. We're grateful here in Minnesota that we have not yet faced the worst of the intimidation and threats that we've seen in Arizona, in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, in Colorado, and Georgia and other places. But Minnesota election workers are not immune, and we must not be naive. Unfortunately, this problem is only growing, and the pattern is a national trend. In Elections Committee, we heard from Michael Stahlberger, an elections administrator from Blue Earth County, on behalf of MACO, the Minnesota Association of Counties, shared a survey they'd conducted of election of county and city election officials here in Minnesota on the topics, and the results are eye-opening. 57% of the respondents said that they have been intimidated while performing their duties. 46% said that they have taken additional physical security measures to protect polling places and elections offices. 26.9% reported having removed a precinct election official before neglect of duty, misconduct, or tampering. They shared that on average they're worried about the security and safety as they prepare for future elections in 2024 and beyond. It's leading to a growing anxiety in the tens of thousands of Minnesotans who serve as our elections officials. And in the last couple of years, we've seen an uptick of retirements from local elections administrators and a shortage of election judge. In Minnesota, we have an opportunity to act together to show our local elections officials that this conduct, threats, intimidation, interference is unacceptable and it's illegal. We can draw a clear line that intentional interference or tampering with machines and our voter lists will not be tolerated. This bill provides that protection for election workers in their official duties by safeguarding and safeguards the functions of local elections administration. It protects workers and ensures that we have the legal tools to do the job there for them to do their job of administering our elections without intimidation and interference. So if you look in the bill, it protects them from intimidation like death threats or physical threats or coercion. It includes protections so that elections officials can do their job fear of obstruction or interference or hindering, like blocking access to a polling place or efforts to gain unauthorized entry. And it prohibits election officials from doxing that could lead to unauthorized disclosure of their information. It also protects critical elections infrastructure, including prohibiting tampering with voting equipment, unauthorized access, tampering with ballot boxes and drop boxes, tampering with voter registration lists and polling rosters, and unauthorized access of the state voter registration system. Much of this bill is building on Minnesota statutes already on the books to protect voters, other public servants, and important legal processes. And over the past 2 years, we've gotten a lot of feedback from local elections administrators, prosecutors, elections experts, and the Secretary of State to tailor the language and the remedies to protect these workers and the work that they're doing. With this important piece of legislation, we can draw a clear line of what's allowed and what is not allowed, and that intimidation of election workers and an interference with our system is illegal and unacceptable. With that, Madam Chair, I will turn it back to you for questions.
Thank you, Representative Freeman. Do we have any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? All right, I'm not seeing any, so we will move on to member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious regarding the process outlined in lines 410 through 420. Can you provide me with an actual or hypothetical example of how that would play out? So the Attorney General, County Attorney, or an election official has reasonable basis to believe that an individual or entity intends to commit a prohibited act. What would that look like? Like, what type of scenario would arise where an official would have reason to believe that a violation of this act will occur, and then what would the effect of that civil action be?
And I'll just tell you that this is going to judiciary as the next stop, but I will go ahead and let Representative Freeman answer that question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson, for letting me sort of lay out. This bill has both criminal and civil penalties, and in the criminal context, given the constitutional requirement, there is an intentional standard. So if you look at the way the bill is written, if you for various provisions, it requires showing that they intended the action. In a civil context, and I know I will be brief on this because I know we're going to judiciary next, it is a reasonable person standard. It's an objective standard. And the reason that we use that standard is in cases, what we're trying to do is prevent the behavior. In the criminal criminal context. We're trying to prevent it, but we're also in the context of punishing it. We want to make sure that folks can go in with an injunction. So, for instance, if you are if doxing, right, if we know that that someone is intending to or has started to disseminate the information, we want in that context either the individual or on the civil side, the Attorney General can go to court and show that they have a reasonable basis that to show that that harm would be caused and that a reasonable person in that context, the reasonable person standard would have intended that that harm to be caused. I will just also note that as far as the Attorney General goes, we can talk about their power in the in judiciary. In the criminal context, it leaves the criminal enforcement to the folks who normally enforce our criminal laws, which is the city and county attorneys.
Thank you. Representative Hudson.
Thank you. That speaks to the next question I had, which was the purpose of the appropriation for the Attorney General. So you're saying that would be focused on civil as opposed to criminal. Thank you.
Agreement set. Just a quick yes or no.
Yep.
Thank you. All right. Further discussion? All right. Well, I'm not seeing any other member discussion, and so I will do you want to make any closing comments, Representative Greenman?
I would just say, and I appreciate the conversation, and I appreciate the conversation we're going to have in judiciary as well. These are folks who don't sign up for public glory, and they don't expect it to put a target on their back. And so what we're doing here, and what I think is really important as we think about doing this together, acknowledging the rising threat, giving law enforcement, giving these individuals the legal tools they need to ensure that they can do their jobs safely, with the public trust, and that we have their back. So with that, Madam Chair, I would ask for your support.
All right. I'll renew my motion that House File 635 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you so much. Our next bill on the agenda is House File 1234. I'm so excited to say that, Representative Herr. It's not quite as fun as my House File 1989, the ticketing bill, but. All right, so I will move that House File 1234 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. I will also move the A3 amendment. And it's my understanding, Representative Herr, that you wanted nonpartisan staff to explain that amendment.
I can talk briefly to Madam Chair. I can talk briefly to the amendment, and if people have, because it would be great if we just maybe added all of the amendments, and then we could just talk through them, because it'll put the bill in the form that it needs to be. But
that sounds fine. So okay. What we'll do then is we'll go ahead and move the A3 amendment. Those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the A3 amendment is adopted. And then next we have the A1 amendment, and I will also move the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. And now, Representative Herr, if you'd like to explain your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee, for giving us the opportunity to bring House File 1234 in front of all of you. This is the bill that has been in the making for over two years and has many, many stakeholders who have been a part of this, the Association of Minnesota Counties, Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, Law Enforcement, Labor Services, League of Minnesota Cities, our police chiefs, our fire chiefs, our sheriff's association. They've all been at the table to have conversations to get the bill to where it is. The bill has been through 11 revisions, and the A3 today had 5 revisions themselves with all of the group members. And, this bill is the result of a lot of hard work by a lot of different people to try to solve a situation that it can be quite challenging. And I know that you are all limited in time today. What I can do is that I can have partisan staff actually just walk through the entire bill. Just know that the A1 is actually for specifically related to PARA, which is the retirement plan that manages the actually duty disability benefits. And then the A3 amendment is the language that between all of the different entities for us to clarify so that we can put the bill in the form that it needs to be in order for us to move forward. So then know that that's specifically to the process in which somebody requests a duty disability and how that works. And so with that, if you wouldn't mind, Madam Chair, to have the nonpartisan staff explain the bill, walk through the bill, that would be greatly appreciated.
Sounds good. And we have Marta James with us here to do that. So go ahead, Ms. James.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So I will go through the bill as amended by the A1 and the A3, very high level walkthrough for all of you. So the substance of the bill is that it adds a new psychological treatment requirement for peace officers and firefighters before they would be eligible to apply for a duty disability benefit. And so this would apply to members of the State Patrol Retirement Plan under MSRS, as well as members of the Police and Fire Plan, and I believe the Correctional Plan under PARA. So under this new process, they would either apply to MSRS or PARA, and they would be eligible for up to 24 weeks of treatment for a psychological condition. To do that, they would have to establish that they have that psychological condition and that they otherwise meet the employment requirements and aren't able to perform their duties. So then they would do that treatment. There are specifications in the bill about how that treatment needs to be conducted at the purview of their mental health provider, and that provider would need to report on their condition and prognosis at the end. At the end of up to 24 weeks, there would be one of three determinations. Either the employee would there would be a determination that they could benefit from additional treatment, and so that would lead to up to 8 more weeks of treatment. They also could be found to be able to return to work, and specific to a psychological condition, that would mean either the position they were in at the time of injury or a similarly situated position. Or finally, there can be a determination that they've met the treatment requirements, at which point they would then be able to apply for duty disability as provided under existing law. A couple things I just wanted to point out specific to public safety, and some of these are the changes that were made in the A3 amendment. For this treatment process up to 24 weeks, the current employee would be eligible for continued salary and benefits, and that would be at the cost of the employer, and the employer would also be paying for the treatment. There is a reimbursement and appropriation in the bill to the public, Commissioner of Public Safety for these amounts. And the other thing to point out is that there's a fitness for duty presumption. The bill lays out how that would work, but that would relate to if a medical provider indicated that they are able to return to the same or similar position. One other piece of the bill is the continued health insurance for disabled peace officers and firefighters. That's an existing statute, 299A.465 subdivision 4. This bill does provide funding at a full level for that. To get reimbursement for that funding, though, there would now be a wellness training requirement, which is also a new addition in this bill. So those parallel positions for either MSRS or PARA are found and they are the substance of the bill. The remainder of the bill then makes technical changes to the existing statutes to reflect this new eligibility requirement for a psychological condition. And then, like Representative Kerr mentioned, for the A1 amendment, that is a technical pensions amendment. And so there are several sections of the PARA statute that are added to the bill as amended that make changes to process benefits, that type of thing for disability benefits. And that is just a high-level overview of the bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. That was really helpful. Appreciate that. And do you, Representative Herron, to turn to your testifiers now at this point?
Yes, and I do have some, Madam Chair, I do have some background information and some reason why this bill is needed, but I know that you are short for time, and so I don't need to go over that. And when questions come up, I can just answer them as they come, but that way we can just give time for the testifiers.
Perfect. Thank you. We appreciate that. First on our list, we have Jenny Max. And then next up, if you want to make your way down, John Swenson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and you can begin your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Mahler and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jenny Max, and I'm the city administrator for the city of Nisswa, as well as first vice president for the League of Minnesota Cities. I would like to thank the committee and the bill's author, Representative Herr, for the opportunity to provide testimony in support of the public safety-related duty disability reform. And I also like to express my appreciation to all of the stakeholder groups who have worked in good faith throughout this process for many years now. I'm confident that NISWA's story isn't unique regarding the challenges relating to duty disability. A longtime officer of the city of NISWA filed for a duty disability claim, and the city was informed that these benefits were approved by PERA. The financial impact for this one claim was over $350,000, spanning over a 24-year period, resulting in a 14% levy increase to the city. This was a significant and unanticipated budget impact that a small city like NISWA, it becomes very challenging for a small city to navigate those unanticipated financial impacts. Along with that, and those important financial and complex impacts, is really the human impact. We all know that public safety personnel play an integral role in the services that cities provide. And for NISWA, we want to make sure that we're supporting our public safety personnel to provide those services to our residents, our businesses, and our visitors. And in 2022, the city adopted a new mental health policy for our NISWA Police Department. This policy provides mental health resources to our police officers at no cost to the employee, paid for by the city. And it was a first step and a small way to show that we supported our law enforcement personnel and that we wanted to provide them with a long and fruitful career in public service. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you. Next up, we have John Swenson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
John Swenson, Public Safety Director for the City of Lionel Lakes, and today I'm testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. Madam Chair and members of the committee, first I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1234 on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. I would like to thank Representative Herr and Representative Long for their work on this vitally important legislation. I have had the honor and privilege of serving as a police officer for 30 years in the communities of Minneapolis, White Bear Lake, and Lionel Lakes. And I have seen the toll that our profession can take on police officers and firefighters. I know this legislation will help police officers and firefighters stay healthy and continue to serve in our honorable professions. We have worked very hard with other stakeholders over the last 2 years to address mental health injuries of our first responders. Through our work, we learned from mental health experts that mental health injuries are highly treatable, particularly post-traumatic stress disorder. We provide treatment to our first responders who sustain physical injuries. We need to provide treatment for our first responders that sustain mental health injuries. And this legislation will do just that. Key to keeping our staff healthy is a focus on prevention, which must be a top priority of agencies, city leadership, and employees. This legislation also addresses prevention by ensuring that all public safety entities have training and programming focused on the wellness of our police officers and firefighters. We ask the members of this committee to support this important legislation and move it forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We'll move on now to public testimony. We have several people sign up too. We've got Reed LeBeau. And then on deck, we have Lindsay Rowland. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Reed LeBeau on behalf of the MPPOA. We just want to thank Representative Herr and all of the other stakeholders for the many hours in crafting this legislation and the time and attention and thought that they've given to making sure that our pension stays solvent. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much. All right, Lindsay Rowland. And then on deck, we have Alan Watt. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Lindsay Rowland, attorney at Muser, Yackley & Rowland, a law firm that represents three of four first responders who apply for duty disability benefits. I am here today representing the interests of first responders whose voices have not been heard as part of the process of developing this bill. I oppose House Bill 1234 and PERA's proposed amendments, Amendment 1A, for the following reasons. First, the bill complicates an already complicated process of applying for duty disability benefits based on a psychological injury, and the uncertainty created by the new rules requiring members to reapply for these benefits each year only adds to the stress of first responders in mental health crisis. Second, the proposed amendments impose severe penalties on duty disabled first responders who return to work in a new profession, which would have a catastrophic impact on those who are trying to rebuild their lives after injury. Third, the bill and related amendments do not incorporate input from key stakeholders, including the Hennepin County Association of Paramedics and EMTs, who are also impacted by the proposed changes, the Department of Labor and Industry, and the thousands of duty disabled first responders who are most impacted by the proposed changes. To conclude, helping first responders access mental health treatment and return to work is a noble goal. But rather than rushing to pass any bill, we should be doing the work to pass the right bill. For these reasons, I oppose House Bill 1234.
Thanks for your testimony. And next we have Ellen Watt. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and you can begin your testimony.
Sorry, ma'am. My name is Alan Watt.
Oh, if you don't mind sitting, able to sit. Sorry, these microphones.
Force the habit.
Yeah, no worries. All right, go ahead.
My name is Alan Watt. I was a police officer for approximately 25 years in various agencies such as the City of Crystal, Anoka County, Sheriff's Office, Metro Transit PD, and my last assignment was the Upper Sioux Indian Reservation. The statement I'm going to give is pretty brief, so I apologize if I don't look at all of you while I'm reading this because I only have 90 seconds. The main reason I got involved in law enforcement is that my mother was a victim of domestic violence, which is, again, one of the reasons why I became a police officer. I spent 25 years of my life protecting those in need, and unfortunately, I reached a point in my life where my body betrayed me. I was a victim of not one, but two strokes. And at that moment, it was decided by someone else other than myself that my career was over. That was not something I wanted nor wished on anybody. But it happened. So obviously my choices were gone. They were taken from me. I was told that I was no longer fit for duty, that I was required to retire under a medical retirement, which I did not want because I still felt I had something to offer. Presently, what I'm getting for my duty disability, I apologize, is not even sufficient to cover any of my expenses. I've been getting paid less than half what I would be making as a police officer. And every day it hurts because you have to realize that you wake up to the same situation every day, dealing with the fact that, again, your livelihood is taken away from you, not because of something that you did, but with something that happened to you. It was to the point where I had to actually go out and find a job working as an Amazon worker in one of their factories, manual labor. And again, that doesn't even cover all my expenses. I'm still always trying to find more ways to generate income so that I can keep the lifestyle that I've generated not only for myself, but also for my family. I guess my main question, and I apologize, my main question is why make a process that's already harder for the individual? I mean, I put my time in, I made the sacrifices, I did everything you asked me to do, and now when I need help, I'm told I have to go through more steps, suffer more than what I've already gone through. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us. We appreciate your testimony. Anybody else from the public who wishes to testify on this bill? I'm not seeing anyone, so we will move on to member discussion. Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative Herr, for bringing this bill forward. I guess my question is about when they get released, and I appreciate it because most officers see about 850 critical incidents in their lifetime, and this gives them a chance to get back into the field that they want to work in. I guess my question would be, after they've been, if they've been cleared to come back to work, that's great. If they can't, is it like a disability where they can they help find them a secondary career. Is that part of this process?
Representative Perk.
Madam Chair and Representative Wade, thank you for the question. I don't know the specifics of that piece of it, if they help them find a job, but their benefits, should they go through the process, their duty to serve, they're entitled to that, and they would get the same benefits, the benefits that are owed to them. But, you know, whether an employer helps them find another job, that's a process piece that that is not a part of this bill.
Representative Woody.
Thank you. And because I've seen officers go out on disability, unfortunately, and you know, they signed up for this career, and they want to stay in the career. But also there's been tools to help them. The other part that I like, since I've been retired 6 years, is departments are looking at a wellness program. Because, like I said, those 850 critical incidents that they see a year can have such a big impact on them. So having that wellness program within the PDs are well. And so I do appreciate you bringing this bill forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I heard one of the testifiers describe the impact of disability as significant and unanticipated, which is interesting because the program was originally developed to anticipate that there was going to be some degree of need for folks in this profession to receive disability benefits. And if you look historically at the numbers, the individual claims are relatively flat and then start to ramp up pretty rapidly at a particular point around about 2019-2020. In 2013 there were 278 claims, and in 2022 there were 779. That's almost triple. So what's going on there? Why is that happening? I'd be interested in your thoughts, Representative Herr, on why the necessity for this bill has presented itself.
Representative Herr.
Madam Chair, Representative Hudson, thank you for the question. So my numbers are a little bit different than yours, but you are correct that the trend has been going up, and it's gone exponentially. From our numbers in 2019, it was 118 applications, and by 2022, there was 257. What we've done through this process is that I try to never assume somebody's motives and why people are taking, duty disability. What I can say is that law enforcement has gotten a lot harder. There has been a lot more demand on our officers, and so and our firefighters, and we're asking them to do more, especially, you know, with us wanting them to provide different services that they might have in the past, or to adjust how they do their work. And so there's just a lot of greater demands on them. And so, yes, so there are more people who are experiencing mental health conditions on the job, and we want to make sure that those individuals get the support that they need and the treatment that they need so they can go back to the job. But we also, you know, have heard anecdotally that there are people who understand how the system works, and they're able to navigate the system for potentially personal gains. And that is why we have what we did put in place, that we don't want to hurt officers and law enforcement who legitimately need this help to get them what they need up front, and then to give them their benefits. And that's why we did put in the annual review. But we also wanted to ensure that if there should be situations where there are those individuals, few bad actors that might be a part of this, whether it is on the employer's part or the employee's part, that we had the mechanisms in place. And so there are a confluence of reasons as to why we are seeing that increase. And I, like I said, I don't want to assume motives. I think it'd be really good for members who might have a question to talk directly with MPPOA or our sheriffs or our chiefs, and they could give you a better indication. I don't want to speak for all of them.
Yeah, and I'll just add, and this is maybe shouldn't say something you don't know the answer to, but I thought the legislature had changed the presumption a couple years ago to sort of take away the burden of proving some of these claims. I'm seeing a lot of head nods too, which could also account for the increase, I suppose. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Herr. So bad actors who can navigate the system in order to affect it for personal gain, that's it, to the extent that that's true, I have to imagine it's always been true. Unless the suggestion's being made that the change in recent years to the standard has enabled a bunch of new bad actors, which is an interesting suggestion. But I appreciate you acknowledging the fact that it has become more difficult for our peace officers and our first responders in recent years. The context has changed, and I think we'd be remiss if we went through this hearing and did not acknowledge part of that context, which has been the widespread demonization of this profession in the political discourse, calling them racists, calling them white supremacists, persecuting them. A state representative from this chamber, former, stood outside one of their homes as part of a group of protesters and threatened to burn his city down. I'm sure that has nothing to do with the fact that we now have to hear a bill.
Representative Hudson, we're getting off the focus
we're
of
not.
The bill here.
The focus of this bill is addressing a crisis that has been created.
Representative Hudson, you're very close to being called out of order. Please.
That would be terrible. What a price to pay for standing up for these people, being called out of order. That would be horrific.
Madam Chair.
I'll just bring it in for a landing here. I'm glad we're doing something about the problem. Maybe we should put some thought into the cause. Thank you.
Representative Herr.
Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson, for your comments. I think that it is really important to note that we have a lot of great individuals doing this work that choose to protect us. I actually have family members who have been state troopers who actually protect us at the House chamber doors. But I also want to be very clear that there has been actually quite a bit of documentation, not ours, not partisan, that states that there are officers who are part of white supremacy groups. We didn't make those facts up, right? And in everybody, in every profession, there are really great people, and there are just some people who maybe shouldn't be doing that profession. And so for us to stand here and act as if that some of the claims that are being made, what we've seen around the disproportionate impact of certain communities, especially communities of color, black and brown bodies that are disproportionately impacted by law enforcement, those things remain true just as it remains true that there are a lot of great people that need support, that need help. And this job is very hard and it is very dangerous. And that has been a difficulty of this job and this bill is to walk that line, to hold those, because not everybody does have good intentions, and to hold those individuals from exploiting the system, but really helping those who really are great actors within this. And we need them. We want our officers to be, we want them to be healthy, precisely why we put this bill forward. And so, and to be honest, it is the political discourse that we have all created and the places that we have actually put our law enforcement officers in this position, the insurrection, individuals who threaten each side of the party. This happens on both sides of the party. That puts our law enforcement in danger. And so if we want to change that, we as politicians can actually make that change as well. And so I just want to make sure that is addressed in this and that we can point out the systems and how it's flawed without having to say that everybody is a part of that system, because we know there are good people within that system as well trying to do good work.
We're going to, and I'm just going to remind members to keep your focus on the bill and the bill language. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Herr. I think it's really important that we do keep it on the bill here. And I think this bill, number one, I don't consider bad actors. I consider a new policy that came out. I was a union rep at the time when we had a person bail out of the back of an ambulance. And I had to deal with those two clinicians on the situation, and we had no support for them. And they still suffer to this day because we did not have a law like this that would help them either get through it or put them out. And I've worked with a lot of law enforcement during this time, and this has been real contentious, but one of the things we want to do is get it right. This is so important to get this right. My dad is a disabled veteran and from World War II. And for the first 10 years of getting certified in that course, he had to go back every year and get recertified. And that was the government trying to get it right way back at that time. And I think that's what we're trying to do here, is get it right, because no way, no shape, no form do we want our officers to be left out. We would love to, and like Representative Witte said, we want to get them back to work. I always joke about, well, and I think one of the gentlemen in the room opened a bar. What are you going to do after you retire, open a bar? I mean, cops want to be serviced. I mean, they're the nicest people in the world to get out there. They're the first ones in line to help up somebody. And the same with EMS and the same with firefighters. That's what they do. They do it well. And that's what we're trying to do is get them back to the fulfillment. And I think this bill is closer. And thank you, Representative Hearn. Thank you.
Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Hurd, for bringing this bill forward. I think when we're discussing PTSD and mental health-related issues and struggles that folks are dealing with, I think that that's a good thing because it reduces that stigma that for a long time has been placed, and I'm sure folks in the profession feel that as well and feel like there's oftentimes not a lot of opportunity to discuss that and feel like you're in a trusted environment. And this past summer, I was actually talking with a former officer from Minneapolis who lives in my district, and I was out knocking doors one day, and he shared with me that in the course of a single shift, he had performed CPR on a five-year-old drowned victim. And on his way back from administering that life-saving those duties, even though they didn't prevail in the end, he was verbally assaulted on his way home. And that's when he knew that there was something seriously wrong here. And I want to make sure that we don't impose any other hoops or burdens undue on making sure that that employee is given the resources and the support that they need. So I just want to, first off, thank you again. And if you could speak to some of the provisions in this that allow that employee to bring forth their story and make sure that it's adequately addressed and not dropped to the wayside, if you could just a little bit.
Representative Hart.
Madam Chair and Representative Ingen, thank you for that question. So this bill provides benefits up to 24 weeks of PTSD treatment, and actually, if you look at the bill language itself, that is any kind of mental health. Even though we've been focusing on PTSD, which is what we're primarily seeing, I think 80% of the claims are PTSD related. And so this bill actually now allows that. Whereas the current state now, without this bill, somebody can have PTSD and a mental health issue, and it doesn't require them. It doesn't give them the tools they need to actually go and get treatment for that. So that's why this bill is really important, is that anyone then is making a claim for through this process, duty disability, will go through that process. And it is, you know, it's the same process they went through before to get a note seeing a healthcare professional that says that they have PTSD. Once they start the chain of that, it triggers then all of the steps in which they will go through. And the truth is that it's not any more cumbersome in my perspective to go this route, because now there are measures in place that the employer and para and everyone actually is in communication with each other to ensure that that individual gets their benefits and that they are getting treatment within a timely manner and that they have the ability to come back. And should there be disputes around if somebody can come back to work, which most people should be able to, but with the fit for duty test, that then we have a process in place when the medical professionals and the employer do not agree, then they can go through that. And it's sort of like an arbitration process that walks them through and to ensure that that person has due process. And so I think that this process is actually more clear and actually gives them their benefits, and we'll give it to them sooner and in a way that is accountable.
Anything further?
Thank you for the clarification. I appreciate it.
Representative Pern.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative, for this bill. And I know this committee is very familiar. I happen to be somebody who had to leave law enforcement because of PTSD, and that happened in 2018. And as we've discussed here, you know, there has been an increase in claims. But I really want to make sure we're not conflating that with an increase of injury, because I think what that actually speaks to is, you know, lessening the stigma of speaking out when you need help and when you need treatment, and it speaks to an increase in that treatment, whereas, you know, then these claims are necessary. And I would just say that in my own experience, you know, having been at, you know, a tragic scene, seeing somebody lose their life, having blood, other matter on your clothing, and just to be told, go home, wash it at your house, come back the next day, and this won't be the last time. That's what I got. So thank you for this. And to say that there are bad actors and in the same breath say that we're demonizing people. These are people who are putting everything on the line, and we should not be calling them bad actors. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Herr, for ushering in a bill that was quite contentious when negotiating this language early on. And I remember from the moment I got engaged, it was still pretty contentious last year. I want to thank the officers for coming up. I know that it took a while to get to this point, but now everybody's on board with what we're supporting. And for me, the most important thing as someone in labor and very supportive of our workers is that we have something in place that is going to support those workers. Mm-hmm. And that's what this bill does. I mean, it supports our workers. It alleviates some of the burdens that has been put on our local government entities because mm-hmm. of the increase in this. And I do want to say, I think as a state, we still have to recognize, as Representative Hudson was pointing out, we still have to recognize the moment that led us here, right? You know, not too long ago, there was an international tragedy that happened in our state, sparked things around the world, protests, civil unrest. That's what led us here. And we're still working our way out of that. But I think this is another positive thing that is coming from that. We're talking about helping the individuals that were on the front lines that had to deal with most of what happened because of that incident that happened here. And this bill does that. It's getting them the resources they need, easing the burden on our local governments, and we're moving in the right direction. And I think there's going to be more good to come as we're working out of this. But again, I keep saying, we can be a model for what the rest of the country, what the rest of the world does around these issues. Thank you, Representative Herr.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Hewitt, I used to say, what am I going to do after I retire? Well, like, you could get a seasonal part-time job with the state, but it turns out that it's not seasonal or part-time, and it's not for the weak of heart. I've got some technical questions about the bill, Representative Herr, I'd just like to bring forward. We talk, and I'm lost in all of the amendments, so if you could just be patient with me. There's talk about reducing the caps and reimbursement. We talk about reimbursement several times in here. Please tell me that we're not going to be paying these people, we're not going to be making these people that have already received benefits pay back some of that.
Representative Herr.
Madam Chair, the short answer, Representative, is no.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you. And I just wanted to make sure, because I could get the impression that with all this reimbursement and talk about that, I don't want someone that's already been in this situation to receive, you know, if we go for a 125% cap to 100% cap, and with all those things, that I want to make sure that somebody's not potentially losing 20% and having to pay that back over time. We have there's several talk about the reapplication process, refiling for that application, submitting proof of the disability. Who pays for that?
Representative Herr.
Madam Chair, Representative Novotny, I guess, can you just repeat just the part that said before who pays for that? I was looking at my phone 1 second.
Who's paying for the reapplication of the disability discounts, for the disabilities?
Madam Chair, maybe if I could ask Ms. Strange from PARA, because from what I said, there's not a cost to reapply. It's so I just can have her talk through these. This is the operational piece through PARA that I'm assuming Representative Botany is referring to.
All right. So this is Amy Stringy. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and if you can answer that question.
Madam Chair, my name is Amy Stringy, Policy Coordinator for PARA. Representative Botany, PARA pays for the administrative portion of it. The member is responsible to pay for the medical report. So this reapplication is not new in our statute. PARA has always had this process. What we are doing, though, is we're clarifying the administrative process so that everyone has the correct expectations. once they receive a disability benefit. Our current statute is vague in how that process works, so we're again just clarifying how that process works. We require one member or a member to submit one medical report that says that they are still disabled, so they have the, or they currently have the burden of proof to maintain that disability. And this just, again, is clarifying the process. So PARA pays for the administration of it, and then the member has to pay for that medical report.
Representative Navani.
Thank you. Thank you for the answer. And strikes me that that could be a pretty substantial amount of money, Chair Mueller, and Representative for the testifier. Estimate of what that would cost?
Who wants to answer that, Representative
Herr? Madam Chair, so you're saying that the cost to get your medical records?
The cost to have the examinations with the psychologist or psychiatrist or the other physical physician people that can do this exam as listed in the bill.
Madam Chair, Representative Otney, that actually, so our members, they have health care benefits, but then there's also costs that, this is where all the reimbursement work comes in, is that the costs or the expenses then can be requested through DPS, Department of Public Safety, in order to reimburse, which is where the costs are coming in. And so from what I understand, the employee themselves will not actually have those costs. So it's like whatever that was covered under their plan is covered under their plan. They maintain those benefits. And that was part of the reason why this is such a generous offer, is that even if you go on duty disability, you get your health care benefits until you reach. So if you're 30 and you go on duty disability, you get your health care benefits until you your retirement age is 65, where you qualify for Medicare.
Last, and then the last question, it's a blank appropriation. Any idea what this is going to cost?
I'll just say that the fiscal note has been requested and we don't have that back yet. But Ms. Stringy, did you want to answer that?
Madam Chair, PARA is currently working on the cost of the fiscal note. Given that this has been essentially unraveled from our process, PARA needs a special fund to be able to administer this because of the exclusive benefit rule for pensions. We can't use any fund assets for benefits that are not directly tied to either retirement benefits or ancillary benefit of a disability benefit. So the special fund will allow us to administer this. We're still working on that fiscal note.
Thank you for the answer, and thank you, Chair Mueller.
And before I turn it to your closing comments, I just wanted to say a few things. First, I wanted to thank you, Representative Herr, for bringing this bill, because this is something that a lot of different stakeholders have weighed in on, and you've continued to work with folks and make changes. Really appreciate your work. I appreciate all the testifiers who are here today and others who are here on this bill. Also, all the people who wrote letters of support. This is quite a wide variety and coalition of letters that we have here, and I think those are really important, so if people haven't had a chance to look at those yet. I also just wanted to mention, too, when I had mentioned that the burden of proof changed a couple years ago, I was in no way trying to suggest that that led to an increase in bad actors. I think exactly what Representative Herr said about the stigma around mental illness and getting help, and that's really important for our first responders to do. They see unimaginable things in their line of work, and we want to make sure that not only are they physically healthy, but they're mentally healthy as well. So just wanted to make that clarification. And now if you want to give us your closing comments.
Thank you, Chair Mullen. Thank you, committee, for hearing this bill. I do just want to say that I know we had a testifier come up here and mention that, you know, we're rushing to pass this bill. This bill has been 2 years in the making. Anybody and everybody who has been able to provide input has been allowed to do so. And so I just want to be very clear in that this bill has been really well thought out. And even then, as we sat together as stakeholders and partners in this work, everyone agreed that we're trying to solve a problem that is really big, and that we are all actually committed to seeing how this, hopefully that this does pass, and when this does get implemented, what do we all need to do to come back to ensure that this works the way it does? And that if it's not, and it's still costing our employers and employees a lot of money, that we need to figure out why is that happening? Why are we still seeing increases? What do we need to do? So everybody is committed to coming back and ensuring that we get this right. And so this committee, we may be in front of you many more times, but I do just want to share quickly that this issue, though we've been talking about it just from what our officers are experiencing, we have to also acknowledge that When we don't fix something to help those who are in need, not only are they suffering and paying for this, but the current employees, the current officers who are working, they are paying for this. That the increase in the continuing benefits, and then because once somebody goes under disability, they're no longer paying into the retirement plan. They are no longer contributing to this. And when they do that, and we have a disproportionate number of people out on duty disability, then the liabilities within that plan increases, and then the entire plan is in jeopardy for every officer who is working, every firefighter who is still working. And so we need to really look at this problem, not just from what we think is happening around the social issue, but what is happening around people's retirements and who has to work longer and who has to work more. And so I appreciate all of your consideration and knowing the complexities of this, and that we will continue to work on this together. But this is a really good bill, and I ask for this committee support.
Thank you. And with that, I renew my motion that House File 1234, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thanks again. And if I know a lot of people are going to leave, if you can just leave quietly, we appreciate it. Thank you. The next bill on the calendar is House File 1370. It's a Representative Stevenson bill. I will move that House File 1370 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Welcome back to the committee, Representative Stevenson. I see that you also have the A4 amendment, and I will move the A4 amendment. Could you explain that amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The A4 amendment incorporates some tightening of some of the liability exceptions that were suggested. It was kind of suggested broadly by some members of the minority in the Judiciary Committee that we tighten those exceptions. And House Research was helpful in helping us do that. And so following up on that feedback and incorporating those suggestions from the minority.
Thank you. Any discussion to the A4 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A4 amendment is adopted. All right, Representative Stevenson, if you want to explain your bill as amended, please.
Madam Chair, members of the Public Safety Committee, I am here today to urge that the legislature address the issue of deepfakes, in particular those that depict sexual content or are used to influence the outcome of an election. Deepfakes are synthetic media that can advance artificial intelligence techniques to manipulate video or audio content. These technologies make it possible to create highly realistic yet completely false depictions of people doing and saying things that never actually happened. This has serious implications for privacy, free speech, and the integrity of our elections. One of the most concerning applications of deepfakes is the creation of non-consensual pornographic content, which is commonly referred to as revenge porn. This is a serious violation of privacy and can cause significant harm to the individuals portrayed in the content. In many cases, the victim is unaware that the content exists and may only discover it after it has been widely shared online. Another area of concern is the use of deepfakes in political propaganda and election interference. With the increasing sophistication of these technologies, it is becoming easier to create convincing fake news or propaganda that is designed to manipulate public opinion. This could potentially have a significant impact on the outcome of elections, undermining the integrity of our democratic process. To address these challenges, I believe it is necessary for legislation to be enacted to regulate the distribution of deepfakes. This issue is a serious and growing concern that demands immediate action. I urge this committee to take steps to protect the privacy, free speech, and democratic rights of all citizens. Thank you. And every word that I just said for this committee member's benefit, everything I just read off was written by the artificial intelligence software ChatGPT in response to a one-sentence prompt entered by my legislative assistant, which I think helpfully illustrates how far AI is going and the problem that we're trying to address here with deepfakes. I have very little to add to what ChatGPT helpfully provided to me, but I do want to note a couple of things. I mentioned a minute ago the issue of revenge porn. One of the questions I frequently get on this bill is this already happening? Is this something that's happening in Minnesota? And particularly with regard to the revenge porn aspect, I think the answer is pretty clearly yes. You have a letter in your packet, I think, from the Organization for Social Media Safety, which was highlighted to me, and I just want to kind of point out that they write in here, in a 2015 study from Cyber Civil Rights Institute, 51% of victims of revenge porn indicated that they had considered completing suicide, and 39% said the crime affected their career and professional lives. Since deepfakes do not have the limiting factor of requiring actual footage, the potential impact is far more widespread. the statements of victims of malicious pornographic deepfakes further clarify the potential harms. Quote, I was sent to the hospital with heart palpitations and anxiety. The doctor gave me medicine, but I was vomiting. My blood pressure shot up, and my body reacted so violently to the stress, said Raina Ayoub, an investigative journalist. Quote, I just cannot explain the level of violation and also shame that I felt, said Noelle Martin, an 18-year-old student. So this is absolutely a very serious issue that is happening and hurting real people. The other thing I will note, and the chair was kind enough to make the motion to refer this to the general register, you do have a fiscal note that has a zero cost.
All right, thank you. Anybody here from the public who wishes to testify on this bill? Not seeing anyone, so we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative Stevens. You talk about the election bill part of it. Is there nationwide been any campaign issues so far that you know of?
Representative Stevenson.
You know, Representative Notney, the example that I have been using to illustrate the real-world implications on the election side is actually not from a U.S. election, but from the war in Ukraine, where a deepfake showing President Zelensky urging his troops to retreat and surrender was circulating widely in the first months of the war.
Representative Notney.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. That'll be all.
Did you pull those off the internet too?
Oh, boy, no. Unprepared. You got me.
You'll work on that for the floor.
Then. I will. Unfortunately, this bill's had three committee stops, so by the time I pull this trick on the floor, it's going to be old hat. Anyway.
It already was for some of us.
Yes, I know.
I'm just kidding.
I know. Act surprised for me, will you? Thank you for the committee's time.
All right. And with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 1370, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Stevenson is going to stay put because next we have House File 2000. I will move that House File 2000 be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government, Finance, and Policy. I also see that you have the A6 amendment, so I will move the A6 amendment. Could you explain that to us, please?
Yes, members who are on the Judiciary Committee might recall that during the testimony on this bill, Susan Sheridan Tucker from the Problem Gaming Association suggested some language regarding access to data by the university and the study of some aggregated data. I thought it was a great idea, had it wrote up as an amendment, and I'm asking you to incorporate it.
Any discussion to the A6 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A6 amendment is adopted. And now you can go ahead and tell us about your bill as amended.
And these are my words, Madam Chair. The bill legalizes sports betting in Minnesota. Let's be clear from the outset that sports betting is already happening in Minnesota. We have a robust black market here. People use shady websites and digital workarounds and other means to place bets. What this bill is about is creating a legal marketplace that will displace that illicit marketplace, and in doing so, providing consumer protection, ensure the integrity of the game, and limit money laundering and other illegal activity. In 2018, the Supreme Court struck down longstanding federal law prohibiting sports betting in states other than Nevada and New Jersey, and since then, over 30 states have legalized sports betting. All of Minnesota's neighbors, including Canada, have legal sports betting. This is an idea whose time has come, or as my friend Pat Garofalo likes to say, no Minnesotan should have to go to Iowa to have fun. Having said that, it's important to get this right. This is the biggest change in our state's gambling laws in 30 years. And so I have been working really hard to talk to as many stakeholders as possible, traveling the whole state from Red Lake Reservation up in northwestern Minnesota to visiting with sports technology companies in downtown Minneapolis, the university, Problem Gaming, advocates, many people, and, of course, many times with Representative Garofalo as well. The product of all of this work is the bill that you're considering today. It includes both brick-and-mortar sports betting at tribal casinos as well as statewide mobile sports betting operated by the tribes in partnership with commercial operators. To put that in plain terms, if this bill passes, Minnesotans will be able to go to a casino and place a bet, or they'll be able to download an app on their phone and place a bet. We would tax mobile sports betting at levels consistent or below states around the country. The money generated by this tax will be dedicated to three causes. First, the regulations and consumer protections necessary to make sure that sports betting is fair and doesn't influence what's happening on the field, particularly at the amateur level. Second, we devote 40% of the tax revenue generated to addressing and treating problem gaming. and we need to be honest. Most people can gamble without issue, but for a small subset, it is a real, real problem. We would devote more resources than ever before to confronting this problem. This would be the largest investment by far in any state in the country in taking seriously the problem of problem gaming. Finally, 40% of the tax revenue raised would go to funding youth sports and other youth programming across the state, but with particular emphasis on communities experiencing high levels of juvenile crime. I think as this committee is particularly aware, juvenile crime is at unacceptable levels in Minnesota, and while there's no single cause or single solution, we know that when kids are playing sports, busy playing sports, they're not busy getting in trouble. House File 2000 is supported by the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association and its member tribes. It's also supported by all of Minnesota's professional sports teams. I did not follow up Chair Becker Finn with the Ultimate Frisbee team, so I should have revised that comment because I don't know where Ultimate Frisbee stands. But the Vikings, the Twins, the Wild, et cetera, all support the bill. And we continue to talk to all stakeholders in an effort to improve the bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We had two people who signed up to testify, and so we have Tracy Wilson. Yep, come on up. Mm-hmm. And while she's making her way to the testifier table, I'll just have to say I was offended by the Iowa comment. In the first, I'll have to talk to Representative Garofalo. My dad's from Iowa. I know he's watching. I'm a big Hawkeye fan. Go Hawks.
I did tell another House employee that I would start trying to equally offend and start incorporating Wisconsin into that remarks, and then I didn't do that. So I apologize.
It's all right.
Situated.
Yeah, we can adjust that. Here we go.
Thank you.
Should work. All right, welcome to the committee. If you want to introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Sure. First of all, good morning, and thank you, Madam Chair Mueller and members of the committee for letting me speak today. My name is Tracy Wilson, and I am the CFO of Running Aces. My goal is to provide testimony today showing the importance of treating the racetracks equally with the Native American casinos with regards to the sports betting bill. It is important to understand that the Minnesota racing industry has been taking sports bets on horse racing since the mid-80s when it was legalized. In 1982, Minnesotans approved sports wagering on horse racing by a 64% majority. We already have experience with this technology and the vendors that would be used for sports betting. Specifically, Running Aces has taken over 10 million sports bets on horse racing alone since opening in April 2008, while Canterbury has been taking sports bets on horse racing for almost 40 years. The horse racing industry is estimated to bring in over $500 million economic benefit to the state of Minnesota. Specifically, Running Aces employs over 600 employees, supporting payroll over $27 million. Online sports betting is projected to represent 80 to 90% of the revenue produced by sports betting. Running Aces is regulated by the Minnesota Racing Commission. The MRC is physically located at the track, which includes a full-time investigator. Sports betting represents the largest expansion of gaming in Minnesota in the last 40 years. If this bill is passed, all constituents, the racetracks and Native American casinos, need to be treated fairly. Minnesotans overwhelmingly agree. According to an April 2022 KSTP survey USA poll, 57% of respondents say they support sports betting in Native American casinos and the state's two horse tracks. Just 7% of respondents support sports betting alone at Native American casinos. In summary, if our racetrack is excluded from a sports betting expansion, this will endanger the future of our over 500 million horse racing industry in Minnesota. We are asking today for parity and basic fairness. I want to leave you with this question. Why wouldn't the racetracks be included equally in this bill? Thank you for listening.
Thanks for your testimony. Next on the list, we have Pat Gibbs. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Good morning. Chair Mueller, members of the House Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee,
Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony in support of mobile sports wagering, and thank you to Representative Stevenson and the other supporters championing this effort. While the organization I represent has concerns with a few technical aspects of the bill in its current form, we remain committed to working with the sponsor and involved stakeholders to find language that best serves the state, the individual players, and the sports betting operators and platform providers. We are very optimistic about Minnesota's odds to pass sports betting legislation this session. My name is Pat Gibbs. I'm an attorney with the law firm Orrick, Harrington & Sutcliffe, and it is my pleasure to serve as National Public Policy Counsel for the Sports Betting Alliance, or SBA. The SBA is a trade organization comprised of many of the top companies in the mobile sports betting industry, DraftKings, FanDuel, BetMGM, and Fanatics. Together, our members advocate for competitive mobile sports betting in the United States. When considering the policies and impacts of regulating sports wagering, it is important to recognize that this would not bring a new activity to the state that the people of Minnesota have never seen before. Studies estimate that about 1.2 million people bet a combined total of $2.5 billion in illegal sports wagers each year in Minnesota using bookies or offshore sites on their phones and computers. These illegal betting platforms do not care whether users placing a bet do so responsibly or whether they are extending themselves beyond a point they are comfortable with. They don't use the best available technology to ensure that their users aren't underage, and they do not pay taxes to or cooperate with the state to assure best practices are carried out diligently. Alternatively, operators in the regulated mobile sports wagering markets in the United States do take public safety and responsible gaming seriously. We want to provide the excitement of feeling a little extra invested in the outcome of the game while instituting the guardrails to do so responsibly. With a regulated, competitive mobile sports betting market, Minnesota looks to develop a safer environment for its about 1.2 million existing sports bettors to operate within. This brings in the best-known brands with the top-of-line consumer protections and state compliance to replace the predatory, illegal platforms already here, and does so in a way that generates revenue for the state. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to provide testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right, thanks. And those are the only two we had signed up to testify. Was there anybody else? All right, we can go ahead and move to member discussion. Representative Beckleton.
So first, it's the Minnesota Wind Chill and actually the Minnesota Strike as well are our professional ultimate teams here in Minnesota. But on a more serious note, I did want to address, and this really is important, especially as we look at how we will all be spending our Monday next week, the comments about Native American casinos and the Native Americans. The difference is that they are sovereign tribal nations. It isn't because they're Native American, it is because they are sovereign tribal nations with those rights and our own constitution, US Constitution, says so, that the supreme law of the land is those treaties and those sovereign tribal nations are at a different standing. So they actually shouldn't be on the same level as any other private business. It makes perfect sense that they would not be treated the same. It's actually, if we want to get it, we could get into fairness, and we are going to actually, as we talk about the next bill that's on the agenda today, if we want to get into that about what's fair, we won't go too deep into the weeds there, but I do think it's really important that for the record, and we all recognize that it's not a racial classification, it is a legal classification, a political classification, that those sovereign tribal nations can choose how to self-govern and what they do on their land. And so I think, I just thought it was really important that we lift that up because the language and the words we use really matter in this space. And I know that Representative Stevenson has made those government-to-government contacts with the tribes. And we can't forget that. That's why the bill is the way that it is. So just wanted to lift that up because it's and then encourage folks. We have Sovereignty Day coming up on Monday. That will be online for folks to watch. And I hope that people will attend and watch and learn something about what sovereignty means. Thank you.
Further member discussion? Representative Tacky.
Thank you very much, Chair Mueller. A couple things is we were hoping to have an amendment today that incorporated a couple things that have been discussed so far, and so I just want to thank Chair Stevenson for working together with myself. I have the Shakopee, Midwalk, and Sioux community is in my district, so we've been working together, and as well Canterbury Park is also in my district, and so we've been working on an amendment that we're making great progress on. It's just not quite ready yet. And so we are all working together to get something moving for the future of the bill. So just making sure everybody knows that's still in process and we're having great discussions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad to hear that, Representative Tapke, because I would like to see the tracks included in on this. And to that end, and furthering upon the comments made by Representative Becker-Finn, I would like to be educated as to what the status, what the role of tribal sovereignty plays in this specific question. Are there, and I legitimately do not know, are there treaty requirements that would necessarily limit this particular right to go only to the tribal sovereign nations?
Madam Chair and Representative Hudson, I think what's important to start with, and I think this is hopefully I'm going to say things that are building upon what Chair Becker-Finn said, and I'm sure she will correct me if I am not. But I think one thing that's really important to understand about sovereignty, oftentimes people talk about gambling on tribal nations as something that the state has given to the tribes. That is incorrect. The tribes are sovereign. They had the right to do whatever they want to do on their land. We have recognized that right by treaty and compact and figured out how these two political entities, the state and the tribe, can interact with each other on gaming. And those compacts have been in place now for 30 years, okay? What is different about sports betting, different and not different, I mean, frankly, you could just do brick-and-mortar sports betting at tribal casinos and operate under that same premise. The tribe is sovereign. They get to do what they want to do. There might be a compact between state and tribe that indicates how that relationship is going to react with regard to sports betting that occurs on tribal land. The phenomena that's different now than anything we've ever done before is mobile, where you have an activity that is maybe being organized and regulated and managed by a sovereign nation, but occurs off of reservation lands. And happy to talk with you further about this offline. There's actually court cases around the country. Other states have tried to create statewide mobile systems via compact and run into difficulty. And so there's a reason why we do this by legislatively. So I hope that is an answer to your question. It was my best effort. I'm always happy to talk more about it offline as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It certainly provides more context. And the reason why I ask it in this space is because I'm clearly not the only one who doesn't fully understand it. And I'm looking forward to next Monday and learning more about the interaction of these governmental entities. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Mueller. And just to follow up, I mean, jurisdiction issues, you can take an entire semester's class just on tribal jurisdiction issues. So it isn't simple. And I just, I do thank you for your openness and being, you know, I think it's important that everybody is willing to learn more because it is legally complicated, but in some ways also very simple. You did state it right. I mean, it's the rights that tribes have always had. There's never anything they never gave it away. It's the tribe choosing to interact with the state in this way, not the state telling them what to do. But yeah, I appreciate the openness to learning and do hope that folks have open ears and can listen and learn on Monday.
Representative Navani.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And yeah, not to revisit the item, issue too much, but yeah, that is where we have concerns. I fully understand and recognize the sovereign status of the tribes, but we're not talking about gambling at the tribal facilities, the brick and mortar, as Representative Stevenson was pointing out. We're talking about the electronic. I could be sitting here and I'm not at a casino or a tribal casino, so that is the concern that we have. I'm just going to wrap with not a question, but a statement. I'm going to point out the fact that we have to have this group. We're going to look at having 40 individuals that are going to come from a background of being experienced in gambling addiction. And I think that just recognizes the long-term problems that we have. And I guess I could pull it from the internet from my testimony from last year as well. Just like House File 100, this is a vice that we're encouraging that 4 or 5 years from now, we're going to have people in this committee saying my life was ruined on a much larger scale. I understand it's already going on, but now we're giving the state's blessing for it, and then it's going to explode. And I know from investigations that I was involved in that, you know, illegal gambling is bad. This will be just as bad on a much bigger scale, and that's why I'm going to be no against it. Thank you.
Closing comments, Representative Stevenson.
I did want to thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I did want to just say two other things about why I think it's important to do this in partnership with the tribes, in addition to the sovereignty reasons that we've already discussed. The first has to do with experience. The tribes do gaming at a scale much larger than any other entity in the state, and a level of sophistication and a level of regulation beyond anyone else. And that's important. I think you heard some testimony about 10 million bets at one of the state's two tracks. And you also heard some testimony talking about how in the illicit marketplace today, there are $2 billion worth of illegal sports bets being placed every year. So in other words, like in a year, there are way more than 10 million illegal sports bets being placed, and the scale of this is just way, way, way bigger. And the tribes have a much larger and much more robust footprint and the capacity to deal with this in a way that I think is much safer and more responsible, which is why one of the reasons why I focused on that. The second thing, and you'll probably hear about this more on Monday, I hope you hear more about this on Monday, because you will hear tribal leaders talk very eloquently about how tribal gaming has changed lives in tribal communities, because it is within the living memory of many people who live on tribal lands a time before large-scale tribal casinos. And I have heard tribal leaders talk very eloquently about what that experience was like and how different their world is now and how important that is. And I don't want to put words in their mouths. They speak very eloquently for themselves. But I want to point to that and encourage my colleagues on both sides to listen when the tribal leaders talk about that. I think there's actually also going to be a breakout session tomorrow afternoon on gaming law as well. So on Monday afternoon.
File 2000 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Finance and Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. And then our final bill on the agenda, but certainly not the least, is House File 1376. It's a Representative Kozlowski bill. And I will move to lay over House File 1376. Welcome, Representative Kozlowski. And then I see there's an A23 amendment. Chair Becker-Finn, are you wanting to move the A23 amendment?
Yes.
All right. Okay, we're not voting actually on the A23 amendment because we received it late, but it was a DE amendment, so we'll just be offering that for discussion today. And like I said, the bill will be laid over. All right, welcome. Please tell us about your bill and the A23 amendment.
Thank you, Chair Mohler and members of the committee. We all agreed that was a great segue to have some actual Native Americans here. I won't bore you with the stories of my grandma at bingo and slots. But we just want to start by saying, greeting ourselves. My auntie leaned over and reminded me, we speak in our language. So, Buju, Ozawa, Anakwad, Magazina, Dodeim, Ajuwinama, Minawa, Bagazandan. I greet you in my traditional language. My name's Yellow Cloud, Eagle Clan, and it's a good day to be here to talk about compassion and hope and taking action as dealers of hope. So this bill is actually a bill that Rep. Becker Finn and us co-conspirated on along with our community. And it came out of the work of the bipartisan work of the MMIR task force, the MMIR report, which if you have not read that yet, the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force report that was put out here to the legislature in 2020. And now the Office of MMIR and who we are joined by with today. The crisis of violence and statistics are difficult and alarming, but we know that they aren't just statistics. These are our moms and aunties and sisters and cousins and brothers and your neighbors and loved ones too. So, well, Indigenous people here in Minnesota make up just 1% of the state's population. 9% of all those murdered in Minnesota were American Indian from 2010 to 2019. And a recent study by the Urban Health Institute actually revealed only 116 of the 5,712 MMIR cases were even logged into the Department of Justice's nationwide database. So 70% of those cases were declined due to lack of evidence. And so that is why this bill is before you with the amendment in the shape that it is, and we'll continue to work on it and hopefully pass that at a later time, and we're looking to lay this over in an omnibus. But what we did in building on the original bill that just designated setting up with the creation of account that we could distribute rewards, this report is many faces and names and fingerprints of our community, and what our community want is support and investment in expanding our partnerships with law enforcement, with tribal governments, with community-based groups and advocates, and most importantly, families and survivors. And they need investments, as oftentimes, too sadly and often, it is left to community. And sometimes it's best for a community to be a part of co-leading and leading these efforts. So you'll see in the amendment, we've added a reporting feature, which the Office of MMIR already requires. So that will just fold in that the creation of this account would be reported back to us at the legislature on an annual basis. It also creates the reward fund so that we can both receive and distribute dollars to get the evidence and information to close cases. It also would allow for the support of community-based efforts, such as sending out search kits to our community so that they could go out and find our relatives and have the resources they need to do that, and fund community-led communications and outreaches, such as billboards or other public awareness campaigns. It also establishes an advisory group. We want to make sure that community is part of every step of the way, and so you'll see reflected is the collaboration is the key to all of this. And then further on in Section 3, it designates the appropriation in talking with the Office of MMIR, for example, being able to get out just 5 community search kits is, you know, in the range of $200,000. And so being able to ask the state to step in and put the $250,000, and then as we've done in a reward fund in Duluth, where this was inspired, is that we've actually had private partners and be able to have our philanthropic partners as well co-invest. And then the other piece and the final piece is just that the work understanding out of the mandates and the recommendations is that we would put this support and resources into the office. And so in recognition and honor for the human capacity that goes into this, just asking for a percentage of the dollars to be able to go to the office to support their staff. So at this point, I don't want to take any more time. I want to turn it over to my first testifier, and that would be Renan Goodrich.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and you can begin your testimony.
Bonjour. Nandwe Maganaduk. Zagate Ayash, you can go on a snobby moving. Mushka Zibing Nandun Chupa. Superior, Wisconsin, and Da Umanungum. Greetings, everyone. My name is Renan Goodrich in English. I am a tribal elder from Bad River Bend, Wisconsin. I currently live and work in the Twin Ports area, Duluth, and Superior area. My work is grounded in missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, Two-Spirit relatives, awareness leading to action. And I wanted to thank you so much for the invitation to be here with you today. I'm working closely with my niece We're very proud of the work that she's bringing forward here with help with creating this statewide reward fund. The original inspiration for this reward fund began with family members impacted by violence, MMIW G2S and MMIWR, family members and community members seeking to find the missing and healing walks in the community and their advocacy work with helping to create this statewide reward fund. So currently that's the work that I'm doing in Duluth in collaboration with the city. And we're honored to be here, and we ask for you to take a look at the recommendations here. And we're here to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you so much.
Thank
you. Miigwech.
Thank you. And next we have Rudy. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony. Or if you have a different order, that's fine.
Sorry about that. We just have Chair, one more person.
Please, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and, begin your testimony.
My name is Phoebe Davis. I'm with the Indigenous Commission in Duluth, Minnesota. And AC Bund Indigenous Webishishi Nindo Dame Gitcha Onagami Nindunjaba. I'm from Grand Portage and Martin Clan, and my name is Raccoon. Thank you for the opportunity to submit the testimony and support for HR 1376 and the creation of a reward fund for information on missing and murdered Indigenous relatives across Minnesota. Indigenous women, girls, two-spirit people are far more likely to experience violence, be murdered, or go missing than any other demographic group in Minnesota. Although Indigenous women make up 1% of the state's population, from 2010 to 2018, 8% of all murdered women and girls in Minnesota were Indigenous. Between 2012 to 2020, 27 to 53 Indigenous women, girls, and two-spirit people were missing at any given month. Minnesota MMIW Task Force report in the Minnesota legislature. In August of 2015, Sheila St. Clair went missing from Duluth, Minnesota, last seen on the 100th block of West 3rd Street, and is still being sought out by family, friends, and relatives. This is an open case and the Duluth Police Department. Investigation continues, but years later, Sheila St. Clair has not been found. The City of Duluth Native Lives Matter Coalition and Mending the Sacred Hoop have announced the creation of a missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and two-spirited people reward fund. This fund has been titled Gagagaya Mikwena Dogizawig, which means they will be remembered forever. The fund was formally approved by the Duluth City Council on January 10th, 2022.
Thank you so much for your testimony. All right, please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Juliet Rudy, and I'm here on behalf of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives Office, which is under the Office of Justice Programs Department of Public Safety. I'm the director of the MMIR office, and I'm also a tribal member of the Lower Sioux Indian community. My experience in law enforcement spans 28 years. I started as a patrol officer with the St. Paul Police Department, and I retired as the chief deputy of the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office. Research has found that Native people have been disproportionately impacted by violence in Minnesota and across the nation. Our office is currently providing support and resources for impacted Indigenous families and communities. This bill would be an added tool that will contribute to resolving MMIR cases and most importantly, bring hope to Indigenous victims' families. The prospects of a reward fund for information on unsolved crimes has the propensity to increase the number of tips and calls received. In addition to being able to generate and renew interest on cold cases, there are multiple reasons why people would otherwise not come forward with information, ranging anywhere from being unaware of that their information is valuable or relevant to the potential informant not trusting law enforcement. A reward fund program provides public awareness and incentive. Most importantly for crime victims and their families, reward fund programs are a beacon of hope when they have yet to see justice. Assistance of any caliber helps victims and their families know that every avenue is being pursued and that their case matters. The measure of success of a reward fund program will not be in how many rewards are paid out or even how much money is given. It will be based on the results of how many cases are closed, arrests made, and crimes prevented directly because of information received due to monetary compensation. The MMIR vision is to reduce and end violence against all Indigenous relatives in Minnesota. Thank you for having me here.
Thank you so much, Director. And nobody from the public signed up in advance, and so in the interest of time, we're going to move on now to member discussion and questions. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Chair Moeller, and thank you for bringing this bill forward. I'm in full support. We know that there's disproportionate folks within our tribal nations that need some support. They need to have some closure. And I think we can provide that here today, so I want to thank Representative Becker-Finn as well. I think we should be engaging in some discussions offline so that I can know more as to how we as a body can help our tribal nations. But thank you. I just wanted to say that.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. And I actually, so this was a bill that I carried last biennium, and it was actually the first time that I met Representative Kozlowski long before they were Representative Kozlowski. So I also think this bill is a really great testament to somebody from their community who is working in on this issue in their capacity in their community to begin with before ever being elected to office. And so it was really cool to actually pass it off to the person who was originally working on it. This is a good bill and is a next step that can come out of the work that we've been doing for years on this issue. So thank you, Representative Kozlowski, and thank you to everyone who's been working on this for a while.
Any further discussion? Representative Botney.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. Couple things I just want to clarify. There's a lot of talk about Indigenous women and girls and the tribal officers being involved. And this makes me think about Matthew Dietz. That was the last case I worked in a missing person. He ended up being found in the Mississippi River about 2 weeks later in one of the locks in Minneapolis. So my question is this, and I just want to make sure with missing and murdered Indigenous relatives, the focus of the people in the group are from the women's side of it, but this is for all members.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair, and the representative for the question. And yes, you know, you'll see some of the language, and it has evolved over time since this crisis. We've given a name to it. You know, it's been called missing and murdered Indigenous people, missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. We then added in Two-Spirit to reflect the gender-based violence for not only women but also for our LGBTQ community. And now you'll see that reflected in the office. And so that is something that we're working with the revisers to make sure that language is aligned as well. And we also, you'll notice, can't remember which section, but we did add a definition section just so that we're all clear about under the umbrella of relatives, who is it that we're talking about? And that does include women, girls, boys, and LGBTQ people, but not to say that doesn't impact men or male identified folks. It just means that there's a disproportionate impact based on gender.
Representative Botney.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. Last question, and bring it up. I think it's a good point. Just a thing. I just want to make sure somebody like Matthew, who didn't live on tribal land, but he maintained his tribal affiliations. I could have called someone from this, and we could have helped with that just to make sure that they don't have to be living on tribal land or anything like that.
Representative Kozlowski or Director Rohde?
It was the one in the hallway where when somebody, the trust of your office, we're just making sure that our director heard the question. We actually were just talking about this loud in the hallway. That's one of the really big benefits of having this be located in the office of MMIR is that we know there are many different barriers or relationship and maybe it just challenges to working with local law enforcement or reporting, and there's lots of fear that goes into that. And so the ability for somebody like the person that you're describing to be able to call this office or their family members that trust us that it's our community. I really don't think there's a much of a degree of separation in Indian country. I think it's just a much more soft landing and entry into that. But yes, you would be accurate that somebody who is not on Tribal Nation would definitely be able to be a part of this program and support.
Yeah, because that would include the documented, the undocumented, those that identify as tribal.
Anything further, Representative Bontney?
Thank you, Chair.
All right. With that, I just want to thank you all for being here today. We really appreciate the work you're doing, and thank you so much for presenting this bill to us. And I will turn it over to you for closing comments, Representative Kozlowski.
All right. Well, I just want to say, you know, in closing, we're really grateful for the support and for the continued conversations, and we'll definitely look forward to follow up about what it is that we can really strengthen and partner. So, Chimigwich.
Thank you. I'll renew my motion and lay over House File 1376. We are through our agenda, and members, just a reminder that tomorrow at 10:30 a.m. in room 120 of the Capitol, we have another meeting. So with that, we are adjourned.